All right, we are ready for Numbers chapter 17 through 20. Some very notable chapters, particularly chapter 17 and chapter 20, as you will see as we get into that here in just a moment. This is our outline that we're following, one of the two we're following. We are in this transition era. Well, we've covered 15 and 16 of that section. We're ready to finish that section and then move into next time the new generation. And so as Baxter has outlined this, we have the old generation, we have the transition era in the wilderness, and then we have the new generation. And so I mentioned last time, and I will say this again, very little attention is given in the book of Numbers in that 40-year period. In fact, we just got into that 40-year period, and we're going to be at the last year here in just a few moments before we get through tonight. So very little attention is given to that. As far as the stories, there are references to that. We'll say more about that in a moment. This is Wiersbe's outline of that. He, as he puts that, we're in the condemned section. He only has the old generation and the new generation. But what I'm trying to get you to see is that there is this transition period from the old to the new, and that's where we are. We're transitioning in this wilderness wanderings. Let's review our chapters for tonight, for the previous studies, and then we'll get underway. Chapter 1 was the first census. Thus the name of the book is Numbers. Chapter 2, division by the camps, how they're separated by camps. Chapter 3, Levites chosen and numbered. Now the Levites are very important. We'll get to them tonight in chapter 18. Chapter 4, their responsibilities. Yes, chapter 5. All right, yes, three things happened there: unclean persons, restitution, and tests for an unfaithful wife. We'll talk more about unclean people and death here a little bit later. Chapter 6 ought to be notable because it deals with the Nazarite vow. Chapter 7 after 6, shouldn't we? Let's go to 7. Offering, of the leaders. Chapter 8, dedication of the Levites. Chapter 9, cloud and fires. That would be a notable chapter because that's where that's not the first time we've seen it, but this is where they're moving out, getting ready to move out from Sinai. So that brings us to chapter 10. Yeah, the silver trumpets and particularly the departure from Sinai. So this is where they leave Sinai and they're ready to head out on their journey toward the promised land. All right, we come to chapter 11 now. Yeah. All right, how much quail did God send? 3 feet deep and enough to make them sick at their stomach concerning the quail. Chapter 12. Yeah, Miriam and Aaron complain against Moses. Do you see this constant complaining? Kind of the story of the book of Numbers. Chapter 13. Sent into the land and there's complaining there, though it's not in our title. What'd they complain about? We can't go. We can't go. We can't take it. They're bigger than we are. They're stronger than we are. We're grasshoppers in their sight. Chapter 14. Yeah, this is where they're punished to wandering in the wilderness for a total of 40 years. They've already got some time behind them, so they lack about 38 and a half years to finish out the 40-year sentence. And so they're going to wander till when? I'm not talking about the 40 years, but what's going to be accomplished in the 40 years? Till that generation has died off. Chapter 15, we have laws of sacrifice, about sacrifices and the Sabbath. And then chapter 16 is important because we're about to get to some things about that tonight. All right, here's the rebels that were led by Korah. Who were the other two? Dathan and Abiram, very good. And what happened to them because of that rebellion? Earth swallowed them up. Very notable case about that. All right, before we look at that on the screen, let's go back to chapter 16 just for a moment. And I want to establish what one of the complaints was in the rebellion. There seemed to be two charges. One was led by Korah, the other by Dathan and Abiram. Let's start with the second one because I want to focus on the first. The second one was, you didn't bring us into the promised land. That seemed to be Dathan and Abiram. And that was their complaint. But Korah's complaint was what? And he's not the only one. He's leading a group of people. Yes, yeah. There's a monopoly on the priesthood here. And why is that? We have just as much, we're much a part of that, or should be a part of that. And so there is an insult to the priesthood of Aaron. And so we're going to see, and we already saw in chapter 16, some things concerning that, that there are four basic arguments. If you don't have these, you need to write these somewhere in the margin of your text, in some of these, and you're going to see these on the screen before we get through. I'm not giving them to you now. But there are four basic arguments made in this context by the time we get through chapter 18 of giving some evidence of the proof of the Aaronic priesthood. Does that make sense? Confirmation of the Aaronic priesthood. Because this is the complaint, that there is a monopoly on the priesthood. We should be allowed in the priesthood. And so God deals with that. All right, now let's go to chapter 17. And here is our summary of the chapters in answer to your first question and all the parts. Chapter 17 is about what? Aaron's rod that budded. Chapter 18, support for the priesthood. That's arguments 3 and 4 of the 4, because of the first two we've already given. We'll summarize all of those in a moment. You'll see those here in a second. Chapter 19. Laws for purification from contacting the dead or being in contact with the dead. And then chapter 20, very notable chapter. Yeah, the death of Aaron, and there is water from the rock. Is this the first time that's happened? Second time that's happened. But it happens differently this time. We'll get to that a little bit later. Now, on a surface, cursory reading of that, what we might think is chapter 17... I see how that fits in the storyline, chapter 20. And so it seemed like he stops and goes back to Leviticus for a little bit. And yet there is a purpose for 18 in the argument concerning the Aaronic priesthood. That's what chapter 18 is all about. Chapter 19 has to do with this period of wandering in the wilderness, because there are going to be multiple deaths. The reason they're wandering for 40 years is waiting, finish my sentence, for the older generation to die. There's going to be a lot of death. And so they're going to deal with that. Does that make sense how that fits in? Why that fits in here? All right. So let's go to chapter 17 now and get underway of what chapter 17 is about. Chapter 17 is about Aaron's rod that budded. Now I want to get ahead of myself to look at these four arguments. We're going to add the third one here. The first two we've already given. The charge in chapter 16 was against Aaron's priesthood, that it should only be of the descendants of Aaron. What we want to be a part of that. So here are four arguments. The critics, the earth swallowed. That ought to say something about God had intended for Aaron to be priest and his descendants to be priest. It wasn't Moses, nor was it any other Levite. It was Aaron that stopped the plague in chapter 16. Argument number two. So what we're about to look at in chapter 17 is, it was Aaron's rod that budded, not everybody else's, not anyone else's. So therefore, he is the one that God has chosen. Does that make sense? All right, let's get underway with chapter 17. Let's talk about verses 1 to 5 now. God tells Moses to gather the children of Israel together and to do what? All right. There's going to be one from every tribe. So you and write the name on each one. So you have 12 rods in all, 12 staffs. And you will, on the tribe of Levi, you're going to write Aaron's name. Now what are they going to do with them? Verse 4. All right, they're going to take them to the tabernacle and put them before the testimony where I meet with you. Now, there's two things that tell me where, what part of the tabernacle it went in. It wasn't in the sanctuary, but it was in the most holy place beyond the veil, because that's where man met with God at the mercy seat, above the Ark of the Covenant. Make sense? And that was also where, according to verse 4, that was the before the testimony. All right? So consequently, take it into the most holy place, and it's to be left there. Now, here's what's going to happen. Verse 5. Might get ready to underline because this is a key point. Yeah, whichever rod of the person I choose, if I choose a tribe of Gad, if that happens to be it, that rod will bud. That rod will sprout. Now notice, here's what you might want to underline. Thus, I will rid myself of the murmuring of the children of Israel, which they murmur against you. In other words, this murmuring of chapter 16, you take too much on yourself. The priesthood should not be isolated to Aaron. Then I'm going to put a stop to this murmuring. Does that happen? We'll save some comments about that a little bit later. When we summarize at the end of chapter 18. But God says, I'm going to rid myself of that murmuring. I'm going to give them no reason to murmur. All right, let's go to verse 6 through 7. Moses gathers up the rods and takes them into the tabernacle. Now what happens in verses 8 and 9? Yes. Not only has it begun to sprout a little bit, but it's blossomed and it has almonds on it. And so it's a very distinct blossoming or budding of this rod. No one else's had done that. And they each looked, each man took his rod. Now you think what they thought about that. When here comes the distribution, here's your rod, here's your rod, here's your rod for your tribe, and here's your rod, here's Aaron's rod. Take a look at it. Now verse 10 and 11. How is this going to be used? It's going to be a sign against the rebels. He said to Moses, bring Aaron's rod back. In other words, show it to him, but I want it to come back. We're going to use this rod. And it's going to be before the testimony, where it's take it back in there, take it back into the most holy place, and it's going to be a sign against the rebels that you may put their murmuring away from me, lest they die. Some have already died, chapter 16, because of that murmuring. And so we need to put a stop to that, lest they die. Does that make sense? Now, let's talk about the reaction of the people. Now, this is interesting to me, verse 12 and 13. How did the people react to that? They stand back and they see, okay, it was Aaron's rod. That was the one that was criticized. His rod is budded. No one else is dead. And they know Moses is supposed to take it back in. Now, how did the people react? 12 and 13. They were going to die. Interesting that verse 12 says, surely we die, we perish, we all perish. Whoever even comes near the tabernacle of the Lord must die. Shall we all utterly die? Now, if you were a reporter reporting about these events, how are you going to frame this reaction of the people? How did the people react? I don't mean just read verse 12 and 13. What's your assessment of that? You're a reporter writing a report of this. What are you going to tell people? You're an eyewitness to that. All right, they're scared to death. Hopelessness. They got the message. In fact, they got the message. I'm fishing for something else. You're right. All these are correct. All right. Maybe they're suggesting that the murmuring won't stop and we're going to die. Do you think maybe this is a little overreaction? Because was there a message in the budding of the rod that said you're all going to die? No, there wasn't a message of that at all. Now, there was a message in that if you rebel, you will die. But God said, I'm trying to put a stop to this, and here is the evidence by this rod budding that Aaron is the high priest and his descendants will be the high priest, and this is my message showing that, and no one is to rebel against that, and their reaction is, we're all going to die. A little overreaction, isn't it? God didn't say they were all going to die. God never told them that.
They were rebelling by not accepting Aaron, and then it, so in that sense, they were rebelling against.
Okay?
And his person that he had chosen.
All right, they had rebelled. But here's a lesson I learned from that man often overreacts to God's stern statements. Would you agree with that? In other words, it may be something, and maybe this is not the best illustration, that you point out that only a few people will be saved. The Bible talks about that a few instead of many will be saved. Most of the world will be lost, and somebody's going to overreact and say, nobody's going to be saved. No, that's not what God said. Don't overreact. Don't overreact to that. Don't overreact to God's statements. They did. But they did get the message. Ricky's right about that. They got the message. This is serious business. And if we don't shape up, we're going to die. We're going to react or God's going to react by killing us all. Yeah. They've already seen the earth swallow up. We've already lost. What was our number last week? 17,000. And there was, 14,000, rather, 700. They've seen a large number die. And so perhaps they think they will. Yes, ma'am. All right. I want you to notice a phrase at verse 11. This is an interesting phrase. It's scattered throughout the Old Testament. And it applies more than where it appears. And what I mean by that, there are people who did this, though the statement may not be worded exactly like this. Thus Moses did. In other words, God told him, bring the rod back. Thus Moses did, just as the Lord commanded. Then notice these three words. So he did. That's the same wording concerning Noah building the ark. So he did, Genesis 6:22. So he did. Will that be said about you? That God told you to do thus and so. So he did. So she did. That's an interesting statement for what that may be worth. I go back to verse 5 just for a moment for a practical thing. Man is often, by this murmuring, dissatisfied with God's plan. Man pushes back against God's plan. He's not satisfied and he murmurs, he complains, that's not fair, that's not right, I don't understand why God did it that way. But yet God always gives evidence for what he expects. God expects them to follow Aaron as the high priest. And so what evidence should we do that? Well, the critics, we've already pointed out, the critics have been swallowed up. Aaron stopped the plague and his rod has budded. Make sense? All right, now let's go to chapter 18. This is the support for the priesthood. This is continuing this argument line. And so let me get ahead of myself. You're going to see this again in a moment. But point four, the support for the priest argues for the Aaronic priesthood. Does that make sense? If God is saying, I appointed you as priest, which he did, and I put out here to the side that Aaron is chosen, is God's choice. So it's not just here are the duties of the priest and here's the duties of the Levites, but God is saying, Aaron is my choice. That's what I'm learning from verses 1 to 7. And they are to be supported. So it's an argument for the priesthood. Now I want to get ahead of myself and before we get through chapter 18, before I forget to make this point. And so I want to go back here. If you haven't written these four down, this would be a good time to copy those four down in the margin of your text. Four arguments for Aaron's priesthood. Was that effective? Well, is there more murmuring? Yes, there's more murmuring and complaining. But concerning the priesthood, it seems to have been effective. There is not a major rebellion concerning the priesthood like we had in number 16. If it is, I don't remember it. Won't you let that sink in for a moment? Were these four arguments effective? My contention is they were effective. So when the earth swallowed up the rebels, Aaron stopped the plague, his rod budded, and then God says, I want the priest to be supported. Was that effective? Or did the people just ignore that? Well, yeah, they're going to have more problems. And the complaining's not over, the rebellion's not over. They're going to go into captivity because they rebelled. We got that. But was their rebellion again over the priesthood in a major event like number 16? I contend there was not. At least if there was, I don't recall where it is. You may recall and can correct me and I'll stand corrected, but I don't remember a major rebellion like number 16. So I contend this was effective. So God said, I intend to stop it. And so did he? Well, yeah. It's much like church discipline. Is church discipline effective? Well, yeah. Does that mean it's going to stop all sin? No. But it sure can curtail a lot, I'll tell you. Discipline of a child. You spank the child and you say, well, they still misbehave. Yeah, but it sure did correct a whole lot, I'll tell you. It corrected a whole lot, curtailed it to the point you may not have that problem again. And the same thing here. All right. Let's go through chapter 18. I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on the details because I want us to get the gist and the thrust of the chapter. So here's what happens here. I want us to focus on verses 1 to 7 first and foremost. And that is, he's not just arguing for the duties of the priests and the Levites, but Aaron is my chosen one. Let's look at a phrase that's difficult. And I don't recall seeing this phrase prior to this. I don't mean I saw it when we studied this before, but I'm saying prior, starting in Genesis, coming up to here. We may have seen this phrase, but I don't remember it. And that is this phrase that he says to Aaron, you and your sons, your father's house, with you shall bear the iniquity related to the sanctuary. And then he goes on to say, shall bear the iniquity associated with the priesthood. Most commentators suggest that is a very difficult phrase. No kidding. That is a difficult phrase. So in what sense did Aaron and his sons bear the iniquity related to the sanctuary? Some argue that what it's talking about is, it's just talking about bearing the responsibility of the priesthood. All right, is that included? I think that's included. They do bear the responsibility. It involves responsibility because, let's get ahead of ourselves to verse 32 of chapter 18, that they shall not profane the holy gifts. So they are to do things properly and not profane, don't make common use of the gifts that were given. So they are responsible. And so I could stop at verse 1 and say God has chosen Aaron to be the high priest, and that's God's choice. But there may be another thing involved here, that they're going to be held accountable for any mishandling or defilement. And beyond that, I don't know what that means. What else may be included? Would those be included? Would those two things I just mentioned be included? They bear the responsibility of the priesthood, and they're responsible for any mishandling or defilement. And so they're in charge of the priesthood. So somebody comes along, you bear some responsibility for that. But beyond that, I'm not sure in what sense they bear the iniquity related to the sanctuary. That's a difficult, commentators are right. That is a difficult phrase. Now, let's go ahead to verse 2, that you also bring with you your brethren of the tribe of Levi. And notice verse 3, they shall attend to the needs, all the needs of the tabernacle. So what's his point? That Aaron and his sons are the high priest. Their descendants will be the high priest. But Levites, not every Levite could be a high priest. But they could be priests in the sense they serve as servants to the high priest. Does that make sense? We've already seen that point. That's what he's saying. So what he's doing is setting to record the very criticism. Some Levites said, we ought to be high priests too. No. You're going to serve whatever capacity you can in helping the high priest. And that's Aaron and his descendants. Does that make sense? That's what he's saying in verses 1 to 7. And they are, verse 6, pictured as being a gift to you. The Levites are given. All right. Now let's move on to 8 to 20. What do you see in 8 through 20? All right, we've been through the offerings in the book of Leviticus. Here's what's involved in a grain offering. Here's what's involved in a heave offering. Here's what's in the sin offering. The point here is not the differentiation between the offerings, but how these offerings were to be used to support the priest. So it's all arguing for the priesthood of Aaron. Does that make sense? So I want you to take the offerings to take care of Aaron and his sons. So we're not going to hit every word, but look at verse 9. There's going to be a grain offering, and every sin offering and trespassing offering which they render shall be most holy for you and your sons. This is spoken to Aaron. So you can take those, and that should be, those were things that should be eaten in the most holy place. All right? But then there are some of the offerings that you could take home, maybe eaten by anyone in your household. So the high priest could take that meat home or that grain home, the best of the oil, the new wine, the first fruits, the ripe fruit, etc. You take that and you take that home, and it's for your whole family. See the argument? That Aaron and his sons are being supported by the sacrifices. That's all that we're seeing here. That's the point. It's an argument against the criticism of chapter 16. Now notice he talks about redeeming, he does mention that, but the firstborn of beast or man will be theirs. But then he mentions redeeming. What's that about? Redeeming them. Say again? All right, had an opportunity to buy them back. You might make a marginal note to see chapter 3 and verse 50. That is, as the firstborn would be given, they're not actually given to the Levites, but in other words, a temple tax or a half a shekel would be paid per person. And so they pay this tax, and that money goes to the priest. That's the point. And so Aaron is being supported, and his sons are being supported. So they took that money, and so but the firstborn of a cow and a sheep, etc., verse 17, could not be redeemed. But they could eat of that, according to verse 18. So that gets us down to verse 20. Basically, what we've just learned is, whether it be this, some of the sacrifices that could only be eaten in the holy place, that was for Aaron and his son. Others, they could be taken home, and they could eat it with the rest of their family. Here is the taxation that's given. That goes to Aaron and his sons. Make sense? So if you're standing back saying, I don't get what this is all about, this is about saying God chose Aaron, and God's going to support Aaron and his sons. He's the choice. The criticism is being condemned. All right, let's get 21 to 24. Now what's that about? Children of Israel are going to be giving tithes. And when they bring their tithes, that's to support the Levites. The Levites shall perform the work of the tabernacle, and they'll have, according to verse 23, no inheritance. In other words, they're going to live in the land like everybody else, but they didn't have a section of land that was theirs. They're going to be taken care of. How? They're going to be taken care of by the tithe. So people are going to be given their tithes, and it goes to the Levites. So the Levites get to keep all of that, right? No. What did I learn from 25 to 32? The Levites must give, according to verse 26, a tenth of the tithe. In other words, they're going to tithe of the tithe. So of what they've gathered, they're to give that to the priest, supporting, again, who? Aaron and his descendants. Making sense? And so we're going to move on from chapter 18. I know there's a lot more there, but that I wanted you to see the major argument. I do want to flag verse 32 if you haven't already taken note of both profaning the holy gifts. The gift may be profaned by failing to tithe, or maybe failing to give it to the priest, or maybe failing to give fully 10%, or giving it somewhere else. I think there's a connection there with the iniquity back in verse 1. All the connection, I'm not completely sure. So, everybody got those four arguments? Those are four powerful arguments. I didn't make those. Those were made by God. Those are four powerful arguments. I told you Aaron was priest. He is still priest. He's going to continue to be priest. And I don't want anybody arguing against that. That's what God's saying. All right, let's go to chapter 19. Chapter 19 deals with law of purification concerning death. Now let's talk about this death And then I want us to move on to chapter 20, make some practical observations there. Willis argues in his little work on Numbers, and you may think when we get to chapter 19, I don't understand where this fits and how this fits. We're talking about the wilderness journey, and then all of a sudden, here's more of sounds like Leviticus. I think this fits here because of the number of people dying. Willis argues that on average, there were 100 deaths per day. That sounds like a lot, but you're talking about 1.5 to 2 million people. And so he argued that about 1.5 million were going to die off in 38 and a half years. And so for those to die off, that's going to average. I didn't do the math on that. Some of you mathematicians may correct that, but it would average out about 100 deaths a day for 38 and a half years. So what that says is there's going to be a lot of death around them. So there's laws concerning purification and dealing with death. Does that make sense? How this fits and why this fits here? So why does this appear right here? Why doesn't this go over in Leviticus? Because we're talking about the wilderness wanderings where a bunch of death is taking place. All right, so let's work through this quickly as we can. They were to take, verses 1 to 10, they were to take what animal? A red heifer and sacrifice that. And notice that that was to be given to Eliezer, that is, Aaron himself was not to touch that, and he was to go slaughter that, etc., and they were to burn that. But what? Let's jump down to verse 9. What do they do with the ashes when all that's done? Yes. They take this ash, and they store it outside the camp. And so there's a storehouse. I mean, somewhere outside the camp, they store the ashes of this red heifer. And then they go get just a little bit of that to make the water of purification. I don't know that there's any cleansing power in the ashes as much as it is cleansing power and just following God's law. Just like the dipping in the pool of Siloam doesn't heal blindness, it's following God's plan. Now, Pulpit argues that Jewish tradition, and whether this is true or not, I'll leave for you to decide, but Pulpit commentary argues that in the whole nation, the whole period of the nation of the Jews, there were only 6 red heifers ever killed. Because it would only take just a little bit to make the purification water. And then take just a little bit more, and one red heifer could last for a long time. And then they'd kill another one, and then they'd kill another one, and then they'd kill another one. Whether that be true or not, I'm not sure. But verses 1 to 10 is killing the red heifer, sacrificing it, burning all of its parts, and then taking the ashes from that. And then the one who did that was to cleanse himself, and he'd be clean, be unclean for a period of time. So God's giving great emphasis to cleanliness and purity. Does that make sense? Making them recognize the tragedy of death. Now let's start at verse 11 and go through 22. How were they to use that purification water? Verse 17 is going to be your key. The person who touches a dead body, verse 11, he's been clean for how long? 7 days. And so he's to cleanse himself on the third day and the seventh day. If he doesn't, he's unclean. And if he touches the body of one that has died and he doesn't purify himself, I'm at verse 13, he should be cut off from his people. God's serious about that. If someone dies in a tent, then anyone else in the tent, any food that's not covered, is all unclean. If you touch a body in an open field, you're unclean. So here's the key, verse 17. He goes and gets some of the ashes and puts it with running water. That would be perhaps a stream. And put it in a vessel, and then they would dip hyssop and sprinkle it on the tent and on the persons and the vessels, etc., and then they become clean. That's all I'm really wanting to see in chapter 19. I'm wanting to get to chapter 20 in the time we have left. Make sense? Why this fits? Why we need to talk about that? Why did God reveal that? There's a bunch of death going on while they're in the wilderness. Let's go to chapter 20 now. This is a very familiar story. Let's talk about this water from the rock and talk about a couple things in verse 1. Let's flag two things at verse 1. Then the children of Israel, the whole congregation, came to the wilderness of Zin. We'll flag where that is in a moment. Some suggest, now pass it on for what it's worth, I don't know if this is the case, I'll leave it for you to decide, that suggests that the whole congregation came together when they came to the wilderness of Zin, that for some time they may have kind of scattered more than they should have, and they're assembling together. Is that the case? I don't know. That may be a little reading too much into that. But when he says in the first month, this seems to be in the 40th year. And so what happened in the meantime? We were just back here when they pronounced them. Last week we were there when God pronounced, you're going to be in the wilderness for 40 years. And so they had 38 and a half years left. What happened for that 38 and a half years? We're not told. They wandered in the wilderness till they died. That's what they did. And now we've come to the 40th year, seemingly. Because Aaron is going to die here, Miriam dies here, and Moses commits sin as well, and we've got to get through all that in the next few minutes. Let's see if we can. So, where are we on the map? Let's see where we are. This is the wilderness of Zin. Right here, Kadesh Barnea in the circle is where they've been camped. That's where they sent spies out up north, and then he came back. And so this region right here within my circle is the wilderness of Zin. Now, you're going to see the death of Miriam takes place right here at Kadesh Barnea. This is a little different map, same area. And then we're going to see up just a little bit from that, and some think that Mount Hor is down this way. That's why the question mark, the exact location, we're not sure. But that's the death side of death of Aaron. So let's go back to our text now. Verse 1 says, they stayed in Kadesh and when the wilderness was in, and Miriam died and was buried. That's about all said about her. No funeral. I mean, there may have been a funeral, but there's no discussion of the great funeral, what a great woman she was, celebration, mourning. She just died and they buried her. All right, verse 2. Shouldn't be surprised. What do? Complain against Moses and Aaron, and we'd be better if died, etc. And why'd you bring us out here and our animals to die? And why did you bring us up out of Egypt? Verse 5. And we don't have the figs or the vines or the pomegranates in the water, etc. And so they went in and fell on their faces before the Lord. That gets us through verse 6, 7, and 8. What do we have? God told Moses, you? Yeah, gather them together and speak to the rock before their eyes, and I will yield water. And they'll have water to drink. Now take the rod, verse 8, verse 9 says, so Moses took the rod from before the Lord as he commanded him. Some commentators think that was the rod Moses had used prior to, in some of the miracles that had been performed. Maybe so. I want to think it's probably Aaron's rod. And you say, why do you think that? He took the rod from before the Lord. That's where God had told Moses to put it, was before the Lord in the tabernacle. So am I 100% sure that was Aaron's rod? No. But I think it probably was, based on that wording. I'll leave that for you to... But he took a rod, whatever rod that was, and Moses gathered the people, and what did he say? Here now, you rebels, must we bring water out from this rock? Then what did Moses do? He struck the rock twice. So water didn't come out, did it? It did. Yeah, water came from the rock. Now, the Lord spoke to Moses and said what to him? Because you did not believe me. Now, we've only got a little bit of time, so let's flag two or three things in that context. The sin seemed to be twofold in this sense. They didn't sanctify God in the sense Moses and Aaron are focusing on, must we fetch water? Must we do that? And so they didn't sanctify God in the sight of the people. God's the one bringing the water from the rock. Moses didn't bring water from the rock. God did that. And secondly, God told him to speak to the rock and he struck the rock. I want to stop and make a practical point. What Moses did was wrong and it was sinful. In fact, for that reason, he's not allowed to enter the promised land later. But what he did accomplished his goal. It worked. It got water from the rock. So here's a lesson I learned from that. Just because something gets the result that you intended doesn't mean God's pleased with that. The end justifies the means, we're told. Doesn't matter what you do, how you do it. Doesn't matter if it's authorized or not authorized. If it accomplishes and does what I'm shooting for, then it doesn't matter. Yeah, it does matter. Trying to get water from the rock, had he spoke to the rock, would water have come? God said it would. But he struck it. Did he still get water? He still got the water. But there were consequences to that. Let's look at it. Let's flag a couple of passages. Let's go to a couple of Psalms quickly. Psalm 106 is one of them. And I just want to, you might make a marginal reference if you don't even take time to turn with us. Psalm 106 and let's see, verses 32 and 33. That they angered him, speaking of Moses and speaking of God, they angered him at the water of strife so that it went ill with Moses on account of them because they rebelled against his spirit. And then another passage would be Psalm 78, also talks about this at verse 22, that because they did not believe in God, they didn't trust in him, etc. Talking about the same kind of principle. Now, let's flag something else. Notice in verse 12, because you did not believe me, to hallow me now is that you should not bring the congregation. There are serious consequences. What does it mean you did not believe me? All right. Very good. There is a difference in believing in God and believing God. A lot of people believe there is a God, but they don't believe what he said. And in this case, Moses didn't trust God. Not enough, because he thought he needed to strike the rock when God told him to speak to the rock. And anytime we disobey, even though we strongly believe in God, we're not believing God. There are a number of Old Testament characters, and New Testament for that matter, that didn't believe in God. All right, so God rebuked him for that. Now let's see if we can finish at least some brief comments. We may have to come back and talk a little more about this. Let's talk about Edom refusing passage. The Edomites were descendants of Esau. And so basically what they wanted to do is, this little line represents them going in and making plea. Can we make our way through? We'll not eat of your land. We'll not do anything. There seems to be two ambassadors sent at two different scenes. Sin in to make a request. We'll pay, we'll do whatever, and we'll travel on the public highway. That's the king's highway. And Edom said no. Seems to be old anger from generations back, and so we're not going to let you. So what the children of Israel have to do is have to pass around Edom, and then they make their way up on that side of the land. And then we get into the battles with King Og and Sihon in chapter 21. Does that make sense? Then we have the death of Aaron. I want to flag something right here in the death of Aaron 22 to 29. Because he was involved in this sin that we just talked about, God's ready. Now, Moses is going to pay the price, but at this point, he's going to be disrobed of his priesthood. So he says to go up on Mount Hor and take the garment off of him and put it on his son, and he's not going to be priest anymore, and then he died. Now, I want you to notice a statement. I wanted to flag this. Verse 24, he was gathered to his people. Now, what does that mean? Well, it doesn't mean he was buried with his people, because this is not where his people were buried. So that is an affirmation of a belief of life beyond the grave. See, we make a sad mistake. I hear this, and you're reading commentaries a lot, that in the Old Testament, the concept of life beyond the grave wasn't there until we got to the New Testament. Not so. I disagree with that. This is a statement of life beyond the grave. He was gathered to his people. He's buried, not where his people are, but he was gathered to his people. That's a statement of the separation of the body and spirit, and he's gathered to his people. Does that make sense? It is an affirmation of belief of life beyond the grave. And so when they saw that he died, how long did they mourn? 30 days. Their high priest has died. They have a new high priest. He can't go on because he sinned. They ought to be getting the message. Things are pretty serious. We've gone over time. We're going to stop right there.